Welcome everybody to a Delco Nerd Network hot take. Folks, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't seen a hot take before, well, it's where a few friends get in a basement and we give our thoughts, we give our opinions on a TV show, a movie, or a game. Today, it's going to be a movie, and that movie is Dune Part 2, and here to discuss, as always, the triple threat, Chris Trejo.
Lisan El Gaib.
I was gonna call you Lisan Gaib, but I thought that would have been too much.
It would have been blasphemic, if you will.
I would have called you like a messiah.
Sure.
Do you want to be that?
I mean, not necessarily. I mean
the new emote in the Discord.
It's
you
in
can
there.
Join.
Yeah.
You can see Trejo.
Absolutely. Paul Atreides Trejo. Gooch. I'm really excited to talk some Dune Part 2 here, man. How you feeling?
I'm fucking ecstatic. And I know it was funny because we were talking about this. We usually get the whole weekend to cook on movies since
a little
we usually
see them marination time
on Thursday. Yeah. But man, I don't need the whole weekend to cook.
Sure.
I know without a doubt, this is probably one of the most perfect movies I've ever seen. The entire experience, man. The casting, the cinematography, the framing, the acting, the casting, everything was on point with Dune. Part 2. Part 1 walked so that Part 2 could start a holy
Absolutely.
War,
yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
And if you did see Dune, be sure to let us know in the comments what you thought. Are you a book reader? Are you just a movie watcher? What do you think? But let's go over to my good old pal Chris Trejo. Are you as high as me on Dune?
I mean, Gooch, this might sound corny, but this is the reason we go to the cinema. Really.
Oh yeah,
like genuinely, like
absolutely.
I can only echo what you just said in a lot of ways. Like it's a really as close to a perfect as a movie going experience as you can get, in my opinion. Denis Villeneuve is a mastercraft of his work, not only at just like having these ideas and executing them, but also bringing in the right people on the job to help him make that vision a reality.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's of course not just Denis, but his entire team. Greg Fraser, I believe, did the cinematography for this. He did it for the first part. He did it for The Batman. He did it for another beautiful film that I cannot remember off the top of my head. But yeah, I mean, this is a science fiction epic for the ages, in my opinion. It's our generation's, it's been said 1,000 times already, but it's our generation's Empire Strikes Back in a lot of ways. Like,
I thought you were going to say our well, this wouldn't really be the correct way to say our generation's Lord of the Rings, but I think this
to
is
a degree,
the,
for sure.
the 2020s Lord of the Rings.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean,
like for sure. I mean, we haven't gotten an epic trilogy. I mean, we don't know we're getting a part 3 yet, but
sure.
Like, come on.
Yeah.
We're you know, Villeneuve,
it's a matter of time.
Right. He's going to finish it up right. We're definitely getting a part 3, but yeah, I don't think I've had this good of a theater experience since, and this wasn't even in a theater, since the Snyder Cut. You know, we had a pretty different gang going to the movies on a different day.
Absolutely.
You know, we went on a Saturday.
70mm screening.
Yeah, in IMAX, you know, sold out theater. Everyone, you know, it just like, yeah, you could feel it. Like
you could feel
it
buzzing.
It's so funny because we've been to so many different kinds. We've seen so many different movies and we've been in so many different theater settings. You can really tell when like the moment is there and it's special and it's different. And it was there with Dune Part 2. And,
absolutely.
Let's get into it.
I agree.
I think one of the first things I noticed about this movie, and especially since it's more probably within the first hour and a half, is the amount of levity in this movie.
Sure.
And it's really, you know, I think a big thing on DNN when we talk about comedy is usually where it's used inappropriately or in places that it just doesn't feel like it needs to be.
Undercuts.
The humor in this, and I mean, in part one, there is none. There really is no humorous dialogue at all because the moments don't really need it and they don't,
sure.
It doesn't really make sense with the Atreides and the Harkonnens. Like, it just doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're with the Fremen people. We're really getting into their culture and stuff, and you're seeing how they interact with each other. And they're a much more, I don't want to say jovial people, but clearly a much more free-spirited
sure.
people.
Yeah.
I mean, in a lot of different ways.
A lot of those funnier moments for me, quote-unquote, definitely came from Stilgar.
Yeah.
And just his love for Paul and the idea of him being the Lisan El Gaib, the Messiah. And I think you're right. I think it's a really fantastic way to kind of introduce it without being like, it's just natural, I think is the best way to
right.
describe it. It's not interjected in a weird way that's like undercutting a scene. There's just many reaction shots to Stilgar of just like, fuck yes, Paul is the Muad'Dib.
He's on Al-Qaeda. Yeah, yeah. Like, every second he gets.
And
yeah,
it's just funny because of how truly committed to Paul he is, in a way. I don't know why. Right. His whole reaction.
He's a believer. Absolutely. And I didn't really expect for the Fremen to have this sort of, in the first movie, it didn't really appear to me that the Fremen would be, like, faction-y. Like, the fundamentalists, and then the more progressive Fremen, like, Chani, who's, like... You know, we've been waiting for this Messiah for like thousands of years.
Even seems to know that it's a Bene Gesserit plant. She says it at one point to Jessica, Lady Jessica. And I that is like one of the larger differences, I think, from the book, this like North versus South dichotomy. Okay. I don't think that exists in the book at all. Actually, in that way, like there's Fremen all around Arrakis. And some believe the prophecy more than others.
Sure.
But I don't think it's like that. It does the same idea, though. In part one,
that didn't really seem to be the case. Like, I thought all the Fremen were kind of drinking the Kool-Aid on Lisa and Al-Ghaib.
Sure.
Idea.
Like, and you really don't get a lot of them in that first movie. This is... The culture of the Fremen is a star in this movie, to a degree, in my opinion, where, like, you really get to see how they live, how their society works. You see Paul... grow into acceptance within their society, which I appreciated and I thought was really cool, because this picks up almost right after the first movie.
I would say maybe a few hours after the first movie. Like, it seems like they've been walking, we get picked up, they're getting hunted by the Harkonnens, and then they find where they're supposed to go, and then that's where Paul begins his trials.
Everyone's saying fuck you,
of acceptance into Fremen society. And it's interesting, he's not really about being I think he understands like what the prophecy is and that it could be him, but I don't think he wants to be it per se.
Sure.
Like, I can't really, I don't know what Paul wants.
Sure.
And I don't think that's a bad thing. I'm just like, what does Paul want? Does he want to follow in his father's footsteps and do carry on his will essentially with we're going to unite the people of Arrakis. We're not going to just go and we're going to farm spice, but we're going to try to be friendly with the Fremen here. Cause that just has never been done.
Sure.
So we're going to try to do that. And it seems like Paul is carrying on that spirit.
Yeah.
But what
desert power, Gooch.
Desert power.
Yeah.
Once they drink the water of life, it's all downhill from there.
For sure. And that Paul actually doesn't even get to drink that until pretty deep in. So I actually appreciated, especially them using even his eyes bluing over time, as a way of telling you how much time has passed and what's going on. And for 2 hours and 50 minutes that this movie is, I never felt bored in my life. I think this
not
is
one point.
But if I
check my watch a few times just to be like
what time is it?
It could be like 10 o'clock for all I know.
Yeah. And I would definitely say if you didn't love the slow pace of the first part, I think you'll enjoy this movie much more personally because it gets up and goes,
and that's why I said at the beginning this walked
absolutely,
so,
it establishes all those important things so that we can just get right into the fucking hard parts here,
right? And the things part one lacked per se, or even in characters like Chani is in a fair bit of the first movie in the visions and the dreams,
but you don't get
stuff.
Much substance,
right?
Yeah.
And I even remember saying when we reviewed it, I just didn't like. I know we're building up to the Chani Paul relationship, but I didn't care at all.
Sure,
but this movie really kind of won me over, and it's like, oh, I'm invested in these two characters now.
So that's a good place to go. Their relationship. How did you feel?
Yeah, I liked it. It really reminds me of this whole movie, and I didn't realize until last night, and I mentioned in our Discord, make sure to join that in the description. I was talking about how Attack on Titan is a lot like Dune.
Sure.
There is a character who is has a glorious purpose, and there's a defining thing where they take something and they see past, present, future, and it kind of totally...
fucks them.
Right. Yeah. They have followers, and there's different sects of followers, and his friends are kind of I don't really know.
Honestly,
and
thinking he has a lover. Back to our review, I definitely see it. Just even from my light knowledge that you've imbued.
Yeah, so I kind of felt Paul and Chani were like Aaron and Mikasa, where, Mikasa kind of has her moments of being okay, Aaron, stop.
Yeah,
And Chani really has, the decline of, I'm not in for this at all. Like, I'm curious.
Which is interesting.
Yeah, I'm curious to see, like, what happens with her.
Sure.
You know, like, is she going to rebel against Paul? Like you know, and, you know, he tells her, like, before he fights Fade, he's like, oh, yeah, I'll always love you. Probably because he knows he was going to be like Jessica.
He's going to have to, yeah.
Or not Jessica. What's
Irulan.
Irulan?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Emperor's daughter, you know. The
princess.
To you know.
Basically,
those,
yeah.
Those house.
Take your hand.
Yeah, right.
So we can become emperor. And
right.
Yeah, I think their relationship was incredibly well developed throughout this movie, and I don't think that's an easy thing to do over the course of a movie, especially when you have younger actors. You can easily kind of drift into the teen kind of, you know, back and forth that we used to see back in the 2000s, but this avoids that completely.
I've really never really understood the hype about Zendaya. This changed my mind.
I agree. Listen, she did a fantastic job in this, and I will admit they gave her a lot. Not a ton more to do than the books, but definitely much more substantive thing in the way of, like, in the books, she's totally with Paul.
Like yeah,
she's like, we're cool.
Knees.
Like, yeah, like, not, yeah, exactly. She's like, I love you. I trust you. Whatever you're going to do.
I'm there.
Gonna,
right.
Yeah. In this, it's much more, there's much more questioning. And that is, I think, the largest change from the book. But, and some people might get upset about that, but I don't, because that's kind of Herbert's whole message with the Dune series, is that, like,
what Paul's doing isn't good.
It's not necessarily good. It might be good for him, but, like,
right. But you're rooting for him, but at the same time, you're like,
in the first book,
I
think it's not as clear. It's written more that he is the hero, and Herbert saw that, and with Messiah, really kind of wanted to fix that image. That's why it, like, the next book jumps 10 years. So I'm curious to see. They changed a good bit in the way.
Oh,
that,
wait. So we're not going to see, like, what happens?
The Holy War is done in the next book. It picks up 10 years after he's become emperor of the known universe, and it's all done. And he's dealing with, like, the aftermath of
it. The next movie is going to be called Dune Messiah.
That it should be. That's the idea. Because for anyone that might be confused, Dune Part 1 and Dune Part 2 are just the first book
Dune.
In the series. That's just Dune. Dune Messiah would be the third movie, Part 3. And it deals with a lot of those questions of, like, is Paul really a hero? Was this the right choice? Did he make the galaxy any better? It's a lot more about questioning your leaders. And I think there are a lot more hints to that in Dune 1, in the first book, but they're not as, like, in your face. And Herbert really wanted to make sure that that message was passed through. And I think Denny made those choices within this first film to just
plant the
further
seeds.
That theme in a more stark way.
Make the audience question
Paul,
you know,
more.
Paul.
Because there is that switch.
Right, yeah. And I don't want to keep bringing up Attack on Titan, but in Attack on Titan that happens where, like, Eren just becomes the antagonist. And it's very clear he has seen everything and he's doing what he's doing because he's seen it and he knows X is going to happen. So he's going to make X happen in the way that doesn't kill as like, he's going to kill people, but he's going to try to kill as least many
Attack
people
on Titan,
as possible.
It is like he can see possible futures the same way. Because that's with Paul. The idea is he can, like, you see that one point where he's like, I see everything. There's a narrow path through, and, like, focuses it on his hand. It's so cool, man. And I think that they really kind of harp on that in a good way, and circumstance pushes him to that throughout the whole first half of the movie. When he's learning the Freeman way, he's like, I don't want to go south, because if I go south,
that's
the triggering event. And Chani, when they get attacked, she's like, we're not making the choice, the world's making the choice for us. What are you gonna do, sit out here and die? And he's like, fuck, fine,
right.
I'll go down. This is the only
the
path
war
forward.
Council.
Yeah, this is the only way I can see forward.
Oh, that moment in the war council where he totally goes in there. And
I think that's,
like,
my favorite scene.
Like, dude, Timothée Chalamet. Great,
he is the stuff. Like, I saw a lot of buzz about Fade, and he is fantastic. We'll get to him. And a bunch of other. I mean, everyone's at the top of their game in this.
Yeah.
But I do think this solidifies Timothée Chalamet for me in many different ways. In his acting ability.
I would agree. Yeah, when he goes in the war council, kind of like, not condemns
it's
their
me.
Tradition, yeah. But, like, you know, like, screw your ways. My way is the way.
Stilgar keeps saying you have to kill.
What's the thing? The one who,
the voice from the Outer World?
No, he says, like, the one who points forward.
Oh, the one who leads the way. I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, Paul, you know, Lisan Gaibi is that one. So whatever's come before, it doesn't matter. He's the one who points the way.
Yeah, like, it doesn't matter, and he will change the rules to whatever he needs to win for the Freeman and to take back Arrakis for the Freeman. the Fremen, if you will, and I apologize. But yeah, I thought that whole kind of lead down to that moment was amazing. And when he finally takes it, the water of life, and he just has this epiphany moment. And that's where he does kind of turn into like, oh, this isn't good.
Probably. And I mean, and the same thing happens to Jessica as well. It's like, I don't think really she has these ill intentions per se. Like, I kind of don't understand why. Is it just because Jessica is a Bene Gesserit and she can take over the position of Reverend Mother and no one else can?
So,
because that she is, I guess, a Bene Gesserit, like from the main order of them.
So part of the prophecy is that the Sangha Al-Ghaib will come with a Bene Gesserit as a mother, and that Bene Gesserit mother will become a Reverend Mother.
So Stilgar pushes the prophecy
to do forward. And also their Reverend Mother is going to die anyways. So he's like, this is perfect. Like, you either take the water of life and possibly die from that, or you survive and we keep going. Or we kill you and take your water.
Right. I mean, by the way, seeing how I do this or I die.
Exactly.
Like, there's really no options here.
By the way, seeing them how they drain water from people was interesting. I didn't think we'd actually see that on screen. Like, yeah, when they put like the water pumps
right.
in.
I mean, not
in.
A lot.
I was thinking,
like, how does this technology even work?
Yeah.
You know, like the thumpers seem to be pretty. I mean, like, I even question how they make that stuff.
Sure. They seem to. I think it's from just stealing things from people off planet and like technologies and stuff like that. And again, these are just humans that came here a long time ago on spaceships. Like, they're all from Earth. So,
right. Yeah, Jessica, I mean, when she drinks the water of life and has the twist and, you know, we see here, like, you know, the spice going into her womb and infecting is probably the good word, her fetus. And now she's talking to...
She's preborn.
What's her?
Ayela,
who's played by Anya Taylor-Joy.
I think it's Ayela, fuck me. Who
and,
we see for a brief second, who's way older than we ever see her until, like, the fourth book. Which is interesting.
Yeah.
So that, like, in the next one, she's like 14 or 15.
Okay.
And that's another big difference for this. She is not born by the end of this movie, which
I was saying when we got out, I was kind of surprised we didn't see her as a baby.
Yeah.
Like, just like, you know, like a few months.
Do you know why? Because in the book, she is a six-year-old.
Yeah.
And like, I really think we probably should have said spoilers at the beginning of this, but you know, spoilers for anyone watching Dune here. We're a little late in. Yeah. But in the book, she is born and she's like 4 years old and she's like, has the mind of a full grown adult. Like,
right. And
the
idea is when they take that in 84, dude.
Yeah. And the idea is when you take the water of life, I think they do a good job of explaining this in the movie. I'm sure you picked up on it too. Is you are imbued with the past, your past ancestors' memories.
Right.
Your entire family line.
They explicitly say.
Yeah. And the idea is only certain people can handle that. And Bene Gesserits are trained enough to be able to handle that type of information. And the other thing with Alia, she got it all too. She wasn't trained for nothing. And that's why the woman's like, oh fuck, she's pregnant. What have we done?
Yeah, and it's really unnerving to listen to Jessica talk to her, you know,
her fetus,
unborn child, and get really conniving and kind of deceitful and sneaky, and you know, she's kind of like, Paul doesn't like, before he drinks the water of life, obviously, he doesn't like how she's like perpetuating the prophecy and kind of like planting things and like, you know, planting information to kind of like, you know, sway the people.
Like, well, sort of, like, he's arrived. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She journeys to the south to the fanatics to like preach his word and stuff. She has one of my favorite turns in this movie for sure.
Yeah, it's
she's
really
dastardly.
Yeah, like, it's crazy. I was like, I liked Jessica and I like Rebecca Ferguson.
Yeah.
But like, you know, seeing her turn and it's just like, damn.
It was
also seems like is she working for like? It's more about her at this point than
I think
it is
it's more
Paul.
About her and Paul. Well, yeah, to
no,
a degree. Yeah.
Like that's why he visions her like walking amongst the corpses because she's. I think gonna go crazy.
Well, I think she's the instigation, and I mean, even at the end, she's like, "You didn't believe," and the Reverend's mother, like, "It's not about believing or not," and I thought that was really fucking like poignant in the way of like, she's like, it's not about believing; it's about me wanting the power."
So the Bene Gesserits created her birth, right?
Her birth, and yeah.
So who's her mother?
They say it. You didn't catch it?
No.
Baron, the Baron, Harkonnen.
That's her father.
That's her father.
Who's her mother?
We don't. I think the Reverend Mother.
Oh.
Yeah, because all of them, they're like, they're concubines in this universe. They give birth for all the dukes, and because they can choose what sex they want to have and all that. But and they can choose to marry them,
but at
too.
The same time, they have a grand plan going, correct. Which is why they had Jessica, which is why Jessica is married to Duke Leto Atreides.
And she was then supposed to have a girl, which she did not. She had a boy because the Duke wanted.
And if they
boy.
Had a girl, they could have controlled her more.
I think
they
the
could
idea,
Paul.
Yeah. Well, I think the girl then would have married a Harkonnen, and then created the Kwisatz and created the Lassan al-Ghaib. That was their original plan that they would then control.
Right, but the Kwisatz Katrach still happens, but in a different way.
Correct, one way that they can control.
Right, and
that's
they can't
the whole
control
point.
Paul.
That's why
the
they
issue.
Don't like Paul. They right. they don't have
and that,
control
that,
over him.
And that's why they turn to
Fade.
Fade Ratha, played Rutha. By Alston. Okay. Rutha, Ratha?
Rutha? That's what I think. I don't care, actually. It doesn't matter.
Fade
Ratha, Rutha.
Yeah, played by Alston Butler, who is going to be like, okay, well, we're going to try to, like, salvage the Kwisatz Katrach, whatever
Kwisatz
that were.
Kwisatz Haderach.
Yeah, yeah. Kwisatz. Kwisatz
Haderach.
Haderach.
Yeah. It's okay. We're there. Yeah.
Yeah. Just let me butcher it every time I say it. I'll say it differently. You know, and, you know, they're all, at the same time, they're like, this guy's a psychopath. Like, there's no way we're going to control him, but it's funny, like, you know.
See, I don't mean to interrupt, but that's the opposite. They're saying he's a psychopath, but we can control him. So
right.
that we can
and
control
that,
him through sex and embarrassment.
Lea Seydoux's character, Margot Fenring.
Yeah.
She's a Bene Gesserit, you know, and she, like, you know, quick role. Like, same with the first one.
Yeah.
Like, we have a lot of characters who are only in the movie for maybe, like, the last, like, 30 to 40 minutes and don't get a lot of screen
time. It's kind
or
of like Chani, like you said in the first movie, where they're there for more the next movie
but
when they get more time to chew.
Her role, it's so funny, you know, Lea Seydoux doesn't have a ton of lines, but her lines remind me of Fragile a lot, like the way she talks and stuff. But like once she seduces Fade, and then
she gives him the Gamja Bar test too, which was interesting.
Yeah, and he passes. It seems like with flying colors.
Yeah.
And then they have sex, and then he's just like, I got the seed.
Yeah, we're good. I got the thing. And you know,
I got the baby.
So let's talk about Fade though a little bit. What did you think of his performance overall?
Awesome. I mean, the scenes on the Harkonnen planet, I didn't really understand that they're like, their skin color is like a normal white person.
It's like a super pale white. It's even like more pale
than
me.
But on their planet, it's like exacerbated.
Well, it's
because
of the black sun. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that was so cool. I mean,
oh, really
like, all
cool
those shots
universe.
In that arena. Like, I'm like, this is awesome. Like, the framing of these shots are, like, the cinematography here is just, like, elite. Like, I was so into it. And
there's only one thing on that planet. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
What do you think people do on their day-to-day life on that planet? Like, what do you do on Getty Prime?
Just be weird people.
You just sit in a blank room on your bed with nothing?
Like, fucking around.
And it's
things.
Just a weird, like, circular black, like, room. And it's like, that's weird. I'm sorry, though.
I mean, Austin Butler, another actor who I never saw Elvis, so, you know, I didn't really, you know, I haven't seen firsthand what he can do as an actor. And he's in Masters of Air as well right now.
Right, right.
And seeing him, you know, kind of adopt the speaking mannerisms of Skarsgård as Baron Harkonnen, just watching him act in this, like, really different role compared to, like, what Elvis was, and
sure.
I'm sure, obviously, what Masters of Air is, and I was just like, dude, this is sick. This is really good.
He seems to really be enjoying himself, and in a good way, like, in a way that, like, it's coming through in the character, and it's just sick and psychotic. He's got these weird three cannibal ladies that he hangs around with that he feeds a guy to.
Is that what he does?
That's what it seems. He's like fucking with them. I think he's literally giving those three women or whatever like food because she's like eat. Because there's one part where he kills another girl and she's like eat girls or whatever, and he like hands him the body or like pushes the body. But again, just weird little side notes like the weird spider person in the first one that you're just seeing in the background and being like, what the fuck is happening in this society? But yeah, dude, he plays the slimy, weird psychopath so well. And I think you can easily step into the realm of hammy and like jokey and like over the top. but I think he holds holds a candle to Harkonnen, like the Baron, very easily.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, when he, like, kills everyone who disagrees with him. I mean, even, what's Batista's?
Rabin. Beast. Robin? The Beast, Rabin. Yeah.
Rabin?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, I mean, he does that shit, but, like, when Faye does it, it seems like it's, like, it's almost like a different kind of hostility.
It's even more
savagery.
Sick, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I really liked him. I like how he gets to Dune, and, like, you know, like, it's just like, we're going to bomb the shit out of this place.
Yeah,
fuck
like, we're
it.
Going AWOL.
You know,
yeah.
And then they succeed very quickly, and, like, you see that Baron's plan is kind of coming to fruition, and, you know, he's not there too long once things come to a head, and then we get to the ending, but we'll save that for last.
Right.
Yeah, awesome stuff with that whole scene. I kind of liked how we cut away to Getty Prime.
Yeah.
Yeah, we cut away to Getty Prime for a little, the Harkonnen planet, yeah. And we're there for like
a good bit.
20 or 30 minutes,
yeah.
And we get a little bit of break from what's going
on Arrakis. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, incredibly well-paced, for sure.
Yeah.
And just like, yeah. I don't feel like there's a dip. I feel like there was a moment slightly towards the beginning where I was like, it's kind of slowing down, and then it picked right back up because we got to Getty Prime. And then it, like, just kept trucking. And then from there, it was just nonstop. The whole last third act is fucking
I think the
awesome.
Whole movie is
oh, no, don't
pretty
get me
nonstop.
Wrong. Listen, don't
I
get me wrong.
I think I'm just really into it. Yeah.
I think overall it's fantastic, and it nonstop is fantastic. I just think that there was just slightly towards, once we're starting to get to the Getty Prime part, they were winding down his, like, Freeman, like, knowledge and learning. And then it picks back up and goes right into the Getty stuff.
One thing I thought that was really interesting, and I think you might have told me about the atomic arsenal that I guess the Atreides just put on Dune for some reason.
Well, they bring it with them wherever they go. So it was on Caladan. But when they brought it, when they came to Dune, they stored it on Dune.
Right. And then, you know, Gurney comes back. He looks like he's working as some, like, independent operative.
Like spice contractor.
Spice dude. Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, just so happens to run into Paul's group of Freeman, and he's the one who attacks him, you know.
Well, he hears his footsteps, I think, is the idea. He's like, I recognize your footsteps, Gurney Halleck. And he's like, oh, fuck. Call back to the first movie. There are so many great
callbacks.
Stop
fighting. Yeah. I love how, like, they're still, they're like,
they're just like stabbing a dude. And he's like, hey,
we're good. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then, you know, yeah, like it's cool. Like, I guess they have like 97 nukes or something like that.
Yeah, I think so.
And they used 3 in the final battle. It's like, dude, like, you know, you got plenty more to go.
And it is fun. Like, again, I love the, like, anachronism of this universe. Like, nukes are still big, every house gets one. Because of mutually assured destruction, and that's basically kind of like the agreement every house has, almost to a degree. And but so, now Paul has the spice fields, which is a different thing. So, like, he can use those as leverage even more so than it's like, because everyone needs spice. You need spice to make space travel happen. You need spice to have mentats. Society runs on the shit, as you know, Gooch.
I was surprised we didn't see Damon Dalsmalchian's mentat character come back. He does.
He dies in the first one. He's in the room with him. He's like on the ground, and he's all crinkled up.
I forgot about
which does
that.
Suck because his name's Peter or Piter. He's like a Fade Rutha, but mentat in the book. He's much more like psychotic. You get a lot more time with him and stuff.
I mean, I feel like in the 84
you get it more too.
Yeah.
But yeah, just to speak on though, like the action in this, all the raids of the spice harvesters. They do like 2 of them, like you see one in depth,
yeah.
And then you kind of get some
with
flashes.
Like the launcher
through.
Thing with Chani, yeah.
And it was fucking fantastic.
Yeah,
it really is.
I mean, like the action is ramped up with this one much more. I think there's like 2 or 3 action set pieces in the first one. There's really not a lot of action. But in this one, there's tons of it, and there's tons of different types of action.
Right.
It's not just in the beginning, it's like stealth. Stuff going on. It's not like a full battle.
Yeah.
Sabotage. One-on-one combat, big raids, sabotage, the big thing. You know, we get a lot of various types of combat scenarios.
Fight choreography itself was great, too. There's a few bits of cutting, but for the most part, they're long shots. You see what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, especially between Fade and Paul.
Definitely.
At the end, yeah, that, you know, that knife fight was awesome.
It was sick.
And I mean, even the fight, even though I was kind of sad the Atreides house members, the two die so quickly.
Well, it's because they're drugs.
Right.
Yeah.
But I was just like, oh.
No, I know.
Like, I was looking for, like, some, you know, a little bit of a cooler fight. I mean, with the last guy, he's not drugged, and he has a... a cool battle with them. Right. So they took them prisoner from Arrakis.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're just prisoners of war.
But they took, is House Atreides literally down to 2-3 people?
Yeah.
Gurney.
Well, by Paul. Blood, one. But right. But like, I guess, you know, Jessica, of course, too.
Are there still people on Caladan, or are they all left?
I think, all of, Bloodline House Atreides, yeah, left.
Right.
So I think the idea is, there's citizens that live on Caladan.
I guess I'm thinking of, vassals of the House Atreides, but it doesn't really matter.
I don't think that matters. I'm sure they were probably, the idea would be they were killed, too, by Harkonnens, wherever they were. And emissaries, maybe, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. No, I think the idea is it's Paul and Aiella now. So.
Yeah.
That's that. Yeah, I think, truly, all the lead up to the end of this is just some of the best character work and world building I've seen in a while.
And another character whose scenes were small, but again, like Margot Fenring, Lea Seydoux's character, Florence Pugh's character of the Emperor's Daughter, really impactful. I liked how she was this inside outside character.
Yeah.
Somebody who's literally right against as the Emperor is being not coerced, but told what to do by the Bene Gesserit of planning...
Manipulated.
Right, yeah. Planning the Atreides on Arrakis and then betraying them with the Harkonnens and then, reinstating them. She doesn't really seem to have anything to do with what's going on. I mean, she's knows,
aware, yeah.
And I guess she, disagrees with it or, doesn't understand
well,
it.
Well, and I liked
and
her.
She's, challenging right. the Bene Gesserits. I love Florence Pugh with an American accent, by the way. She sounds so much better.
Get that British accent.
I think Florence Pugh just has a really interesting way of talking that I don't find great.
Sure.
But I feel like her is in her American accent was more royal than her in her British
sure, sure.
accent.
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I really felt the character in her, even though I know Florence Pugh from
she was
other
serving
shit.
Some looks too, by the way. She looks great. That her last
chainmail. Yeah, veil.
So good. Yeah. She is really the Chani of this movie in the fact of she plays a much larger role.
Oh,
in
yeah.
Messiah.
Yeah, it's going to be it's obvious.
But no, she's really fantastic. You don't get a lot of scenes with her. You don't get a lot of scenes with Christopher Walken as the Emperor.
I
think his scenes were powerful.
I love seeing him in a serious role. Now that he's old, I feel like he comes on movies for the gag, for the joke.
Sure, to a degree, yeah.
But and he wasn't like that when he was younger. And, and I just said, in his age, he seems to get those kind of roles. But, this was such a cool role.
Apparently, he's
Walken.
A big fan of the books.
Yeah,
that was thing,
I mean, I was
cool.
just like, wow. I was like, again, like, it, well, he wasn't Christopher Walken. He was the Emperor.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, yeah. And it's so funny because I'm trying to think,
and even he's a puppet, you don't really feel...
But that's the point. The Bene Gesserit are manipulating
I
everything.
I felt like in 84, the Emperor seemed to have a bit more backbone than the Emperor in this.
Yep.
In this, he barely has much... He doesn't say too much. He asserts power over the Harkonnens kind of because he can.
Yeah.
But he does when once
he's much more stoic.
Once he's in a room with Paul, it's no holes barred. Paul's all walking all over him.
Yeah. He knows he's beaten at this point, and that's the whole point by the end,
right.
of course. But it is interesting because I love how they focus in on that Bene Gesserit manipulation and machination because they don't in that first movie or the Dune 84. And they plant the seeds in part one, of course. But yeah, it's just the Bene Gesserit's world, Gooch. We're living in it. That's the whole point. And, they've been working for millennia to secure their power. And Jessica fucked that all up for she really did.
And the Bene Gesserit, he tells the Silence, is the one who gives him the Ganja Bar.
Correct. That's the Reverend Mother. Or no, that's the Mother Superior or something. Or the head of the Bene Gesserit Order.
Right. I think Mother Superior might be from Baldur's Gate.
Yeah, I think that might actually just be like a...
Yeah,
Catholic
but I know what you
yeah,
mean.
Yeah. Yeah, like the head of the Order. And that scene... When he silences her.
Silence! Yeah,
it's
with the voice.
So good.
Dude, even when the few times Jessica uses the voice, when he uses it on the woman down south. I didn't know. I'm like, is she talking about Paul? Which is weird. Why would... I feel like if Paul went down there, despite if she used the voice on him, they would have gave it to him, right?
I think she's just trying to make sure because I don't know.
Really secure
yeah,
the moment.
And also I think the idea down there, they might be like, they're like, well, no, only women get this. Just even if we don't know he's the Lassan al-Ghaib.
Not that I've read ahead or looked ahead, but I really don't know what happened. I know Paul spoilers, like, survives this. Like, what happened? Like, I'm curious what happens to Jessica, and like, what's this vision he sees of the billions dying and starving, and like, why Jessica is walking amongst those people.
Well, so that is just, I took that as like talking about the holy war that's coming that Paul has already foreseen. That is happening
and
now.
Begins,
and
yeah.
It has begun.
Yeah,
and I think that was almost like showing you that Jessica was the real catalyst in this all, truly, because I mean, she had Paul to begin with, like we just said. She trained him in the Bene Gesserit ways. She pushed him towards this prophecy, and I think it's partly because it's the only option she sees now, but partly because of her faith too, because she's like, no, this is right. We need the voice from the outer world, the Sangal Gaia, to lead the known universe.
I'm really loving these stories where like your protagonist becomes your antagonist, and this really unique sci-fi world of, you know, sci-fi, but like low sci-fi, but like religious,
like
sci-fi.
Medieval sci-fi.
It's very different. It's very cool. I don't think you really get a lot of stories where sci-fi and religion really have a part. Like, I think, you know, later Dead Space kind of gets into
sure.
that with unitology in the Dead Space world and what's going on. I mean, not as deep as Dune. And, like, you know, I'm thinking, like Mass Effect has religion, but the religion really doesn't play a part in the narrative.
Yeah.
It just, like, happens to be in the world's cultures.
Well, and that's,
but, like, this really... especially like Islamic lore kind of
sure.
coming to, it's not always like Catholicism and stuff like that.
It's a real heavy mixture too. And that's why I think it is so interesting and in just how heavily spiritually involved this whole universe is. It's all like everything's in your mind's eye.
Well,
you
maybe
just need
not
to open
the
it.
Universe, but like,
I mean, I think
certain
sorry.
Factions like the Bene Gesserit and the Fremen,
the entirety of this society depends on the human brain and spice. It's not computers. It's human will. So, but of course you need spice to unlock that full potential of the human will and the human psyche. But like the idea is it's all in here. We have the capability. That's what I think is so cool about the Dune universe.
And I mean, essentially dangerous.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and
I mean spice. You know, like what, like the Bene Gesserit aren't good. You can,
no, it's true.
You get that from the first movie. They're definitely, you know, the puppet masters here, kind of,
yeah.
you know, asserting their will over the galaxy and the universe.
Right.
And you know, you see that again when Paul and Jessica drink the water of life. It's like that. This isn't
just
good.
Turns them into a piece of shit. Yeah,
right. Like you're kind of rooting for Paul, and you're all about the holy war, which I kind of am. Like, this is sick. Let's go.
Like we're
yeah.
in. Yeah.
yeah, I'm like, I'll fight the holy war next weekend. Yeah. You know, like I'm ready. You know, but like seeing him weaponize the Fremen and then, you know, assault Arrakeen. You know, like right at the right moment, taking everyone out, like no holds barred, like knows exactly what he's doing, calculated tactics, and, you know, getting up there and, you know, fighting Fade and actually looking like he's really put to the test and almost loses and, you know, still, but, you know, one ups Fade with like, again,
you rarely
a calculated
see that these
move.
Days. Like, again, yeah. where your protagonist is really getting hurt. And, like, yeah,
right.
seeing him go through that whole fight. I mean, that whole throne room scene. I think one of the best scenes in it, too, is when Paul kills the Baron, too. When he just walks into that
Hello,
room.
Hello, grandfather.
Everyone's in the corner.
Dying like an animal.
Just, like, and he just walks right. They don't give a shit. They're like, yeah, what are you doing? Okay, he walks up to the Baron. You die like an animal. Sticks him through the neck. Ugh.
I love that Muad'Dib title. That they give him, and they don't really know who Paul is, Muad'Dib. They don't know that, you know, Atreides, Paul is still alive. They think he's dead. I guess they think Jessica's dead too,
yeah.
even though her.
Well, that's their assumption because they fell in the sandstorm, or they went into it and they never found him.
Right.
And yeah, no, they're not expect. I mean, you see Irulan, theorize that he could be alive because of her like Bene Gesserit training, I think, and all that, but. Yeah, they have no idea. And that scene where the Emperor reads the scroll, the technology in this is so fucking cool and interesting. Like when she's recording her thing and it's like doing it on like it's like imprinting it on the cylinder as
yeah.
she's speaking, and like the one guy's visor when they're in the like the Harkonnen thopter, it's like this weird like almost dragon bone looking like visor. It was fucking cool, Gooch. I really love that stuff, man.
Yeah.
I think this is some of the most interesting and different looking sci-fi like settings that I've ever seen in my life. I was joking about it earlier with like, what are we doing on Getty Prime? Like, what does a normal person do? And some of the worlds do feel like that to me, right, where I'm like, what is the like common folk doing with their day
and
here?
And I was questioning that with like in the first one. It's like, well, like, what do the people of Caladan like look like? Yeah. Like, what are they doing? We just know about House Atreides. And I mean, that really doesn't necessarily change.
No, it doesn't. I think it does a good job of showing you like, this is a very like, it is like medieval times, but with high functioning technology to a degree. Like, you're in this arena watching battles and like, there's probably not a ton of like super technologically involved like entertainment. It might be more like you're going to listen to songs. Gurney actually uses his fucking instrument in this. That was pretty fun to see.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was my only like slight critique, if you even want to call it that.
Yeah. So I guess I would say, if we're wrapping it up, I'd say, yeah, looking forward to the Holy War, but I guess we don't see that.
Yeah, we don't see that. That's the funny thing. So, unless, hey man, he could change that. I don't know but I think I don't see him like changing it that drastically, because that like again
now you really have to invent.
Yeah, yeah, you're creating a whole new thing out of whole cloth. And so back to the Baron thing, when he dies though, difference in the book, that is Aiella. Aiella stabs him in the neck and says I think she actually even silences the priest, and that's when she goes abomination. Like, oh fuck, what the fuck is that? So yeah, that's one slight difference. And I was talking to Cassie and Super, two of our friends who came to the show with us, and they were talking about how that might affect the future movies in some way. But I was looking into it, and I don't think it really messes anything up specific. I don't want to spoil what it could be. But yeah, that was kind of the major one, I would say, like, you know, death-wise, that was changed. I'm trying to think of any other major... Because I did... Again, I read this book like 2 years ago. I was telling Gooch. So the big stuff, like, even when it was revealed that Jessica was the Baron's daughter, I was like, oh yeah, I totally forgot that. That's really cool. But yeah, I think the biggest change really is Chani's character for sure. Mm-hmm. And her like kind of defiance almost. It seems.
Yeah. So I'm interested to see, I'm like, you know, I guess in the beginning of Messiah part 3, them talking about the Holy War and what happens. Cause like, I was kind of surprised that all the great houses like are going to stand against him, and I guess they get wiped out, you know?
Well, that's what the war is. I think they just get, I don't think they get wiped out. I think they get put in a line, like all, like one by one, they pledge fealty.
So yeah, I guess I have questions, but maybe I shouldn't ask them.
You can ask them, but I won't answer them if I think they're spoilery.
Do the Fremen go to different planets and fight?
They're all getting on the planets. They're all getting on those ships at the end. They're going to fight. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the war ain't coming to them.
They're bringing
the war to everyone. And there will be still people. And I mean, there's millions upon millions of Freemen, which is more than anyone ever realized. So that's the other thing. And they fight. One thing that's tough to convey in this, and I think they do it well, but that you can do in a book because you can just tell me, is the idea that like the Sardukar, and I think I've explained this to you before, are like the top tier when it comes to combat. No one's supposed to be able to beat them. In the first movie, you see the Atreides put up a good fight with them. They're taking them down. You see Duncan take out 5 of them, right? That's kind of showing you, oh, shit, the Atreides are matching them. Like, mm-hmm. He's fucking, like, they're that as good of fighters. And Freemen are on that level, too. Like, where they can take down the Sardaukar, and they are an even more elevated, you know, fighting force than the Sardaukar, who are basically just prisoners who are left on a prison planet until they get hard enough and they're picked up. And then they're like, all right, you want to be a Sardaukar? We'll pay you forever. You will be in the lap of luxury, and you have to take care of the emperor. It's an interesting kind of idea, because the Seleucus Secundus is where they're from. We see that in the first movie. And I think that's original.
You know Secundus is the name of the moon in Elder Scrolls?
I did not know
that.
Yeah,
one of them. Yeah.
Interesting. Secundus. I'm sure that might be a Dune reference.
It's probably a... Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if that is.
I think it's a Latin word.
Interesting. Oh, well, that
I think it
sense
means, like, darkness.
And again, you know, Herbert really did take inspiration from almost every religion for this. I mean, the Orange Catholic Bible within, like, the universe of the book is, like... It was worked on by the heads of, like, Islam, Catholicism, like, and Judaism, like, the major religions, like, came together and created this Bible.
Do you like how they took out the word jihad from all this?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, there's no... The jihad hasn't begun yet. That's the idea. So, like,
right.
The only time they talk about the jihad at the beginning in these books, at least the first one I remember, is like the Bootlerian jihad, which is I've explained this to you before.
Yeah, I know
but,
what it is. Yeah.
When basically humanity got rid of all the thinking, all of AI, and was like, we can't do this. We had a machine war. This will get out of hand.
Right.
And then they banned all AI throughout the known universe. And that's when the Yellow Catholic Bible was created. And that was so... This says this is the year 10,000, whatever.
Yeah.
It's really the year 20,000, whatever, compared to us. Because that
restart.
It restarted once the Butlerian Jihad happened. So it's 10,000 years on from the holy war, when they got rid of all AI.
Well, the only thought that I could have is Jihad has such a different context.
No, for sure.
In our world today. I mean, when Frank Herbert wrote Dune, obviously Jihad was not Islamically connected.
Well, I think it's
rooted in Islam, but not with... terrorists.
Oh, sure. Yeah, right. Like there's it's a bit of a definitely when you hear jihad in normal context, you definitely hear not necessarily fair because again, that does just mean holy war. But that's a good point. Actually, that's very interesting. I don't think
why I was asking. Do you care that makes sense? They don't use that term.
No, because I don't think there's a moment in the movie that calls for them to like
say
that.
It.
Yeah,
right.
And I think Denny would say that if he need. Yeah, I guess you could. Instead of holy war, you could say jihad.
A nice article about
it somewhere. Sure. Absolutely. And I mean, there was a whole slew of articles when this first came out about how like this perpetuates the first movie, the white savior like trope and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, all right, well, you haven't read the books. So like, because the whole idea
is
that
he's not the white
it's
savior.
The bad thing. Yeah, it's, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's actually kind
sure,
of
that's what it starts out as and looks like. But, you know, not
the whole point is that it turns out
how the story ends.
Yeah.
Right.
But
I can't wait to see how this story ends and see Velnu do.
Well, and I mean,
Dune
dude,
and,
so there's like
and give us that Dune trilogy that I think is definitely
there's
100%
no way
happen.
We don't get Messiah at this point.
Yeah,
I don't think it's the next film we're gonna get from Denny.
You think he's gonna take?
I think he's gonna do one in between. I think he said he is because he's already working in pre-production
one. That's what I was gonna say. I'm like, okay, like if Paul ages 10 years, I'm like. You know, Timothy Chalamet isn't an old-looking dude.
And that's kind of what works for him in these earlier movies, right?
Yeah,
he looks like a younger guy.
How old is Paul supposed to be?
16, I believe.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, he's only supposed to be... He's young. And it's funny, even like... And you see, I think, again...
Stories are always like that.
You see a lot of parallels, even in Game of Thrones. Super was bringing these up to me last night. It is so interesting, just like how those kind of match up. And even like... So there's this other faction that's introduced in the next one. The Bene Talaxi, and they're the Face Dancers, and Super was like, yeah, they inspired the Faceless Men from Game of Thrones, and I'm like, duh, that's so cool. So they're shapeshifters.
Okay.
And there's a few other parallels I saw online, but it is just interesting how many things really did draw from Dune before this was ever made into a film, and it's wild. And even talking about like, so there was Jodorowsky's Dune, Dilly. Friend of the show always mentions it.
Yeah,
and it's interesting. I didn't realize how big of a thing it was back in the day. It was like this guy Jodorowsky like put together like a 4-hour story. He storyboarded out the entire movie. There's all of these.
Salvador Dali did it.
He was supposed to be the emperor in it or something, and he wanted like
more
like,
he was
money
alive?
Than ever. Like he wanted like $100,000 for the movie, which is wild back then. And there are some really wild and out there concept arts. If you ever want to kind of peek through them, like you can see them all online. I was actually messing with them last night. Very interesting. But apparently a lot of those like concept arts inspired a lot of like Star Wars and sci-fi stuff because they were kind of passed around. So which is another interesting thing in and of itself. I did see Frank Herbert's son tweet about this, that he absolutely adored these movies. So that's kind of cool to see.
Yeah.
But otherwise, Gooch, is there anything else on Dune?
That's pretty much it, man. I'm just excited for more.
I just
need more Dune.
I'm gonna go see it again.
On the wiki like I did last night in bed and fucking read
dude, I mean,
more about
if
Dune.
If you want to get into a rabbit hole, go on Dune YouTube. There's there's one channel like they do like cartoon like infographics too along with it, and they go through the whole thing and they have really great voice. I'll have to send it to the group chat.
Please. Please.
But yeah, freaking fantastic, Gooch. I was ecstatic leaving this film. I'm gonna see it again in theater for sure.
Are you?
I think so. Because I'll probably drag Ian when he's my roommate once he's back from his trip he's on this week. He probably would have went if he was here. Because I think he wasn't the biggest fan of the first one because he felt it was just a little slow. And I get it. It's that pace.
Yeah.
It's
I mean, when I first
you,
saw
it's not...
the first one, I think it was in the same boat for sure.
But I think this one for sure is much more action packed. It gets going right away. And if you found the first one a bit slower, I think you're going to enjoy it. And I think he will. So I might drag him to go see it a second time. But Gooch, I think that does it for us today. Thank you all so much for watching with us live on twitch.tv/DelcoNerdNetwork. You can find this podcast anywhere podcasts are found. Just search Delco Nerd Network. Anywhere there's an at sign, we're Delco Nerds. We have a Facebook page. We have a Discord channel. All that good stuff will be linked down below. Be sure to like, comment, subscribe. Let us know what you thought about Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2 down below. As Gooch said earlier, we would love to hear your thoughts. What do you think about the changes to the book if you're a book reader? Did you hate him? Do you love it? Are you
hard movie to hate?
I know. I'd be surprised hard if you're walking out of this movie hating it. I don't know what to do for you, but hey, everyone's too entitled to their opinion. Too much spice indeed.
Get off the spice.
Email us your comments, questions, or concerns, delconerds@gmail.com. We'd be happy to get back to you. You can find all this information on our website, delconerdnetwork.com. For Gooch, I've been Muad'Dib. No, I'm just kidding. I've been Trio. Stay nerdy, and we'll see you next time.